Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Jeff Nadek, head of engineering at ButcherBox. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you in person. Thanks for making the trek all the way from NoHo.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I know back in the day, your first taste of getting involved with technology was the shareware version of Doom, right?
That's right. Yeah, my neighbor got a copy of that, and I didn't care about computers before that. I was a Nintendo guy, and then that really blew my mind, and so I needed a computer, and luckily I was able to get one.
Yeah, I remember back then, that was when the first LANs were around, and you could go head-to-head with them. That was amazing.
Yeah. Oh, my. The LAN parties were really something. Playing even over modem was incredible.
That's cool. So you got a computer. This is like seventh grade. You're at the DOS prompt. You're nosing around. What got you interested in it?
It just was like this incredible world that was at my fingertips, that even just cruising around the DOS file system was really interesting to me. I mean, I remember I read the DOS manual shortly after, which haven't done anything like that since, but I was just so enthralled by the whole thing that I would just dig through all the folders, do tons of stupid things like delete files that I thought I didn't need because my hard drive was only like, I think 420 megabytes. So trying to optimize, I remember once I probably deleted a bunch of DLLs and stuff and all of a sudden the computer didn't work, but I got really handy at reformatting it, you know, installing things. And I think that was between that and being into the wares scene as a kid, because I didn't have the money to buy software. So just learning how to use program crackers and things like that was really engaging. You know, like what 13-year-old kid doesn't think they want to be a hacker?
Never underestimate a motivated middle schooler.
Absolutely.
In high school, did you end up taking any classes with computers?
I did. I took what they had. I actually didn't do well in my basic programming class. It wasn't super engaging. I don't know. It was on TRS 80s, yeah.
Trash 80.
Yeah. They were kind of old at the time for even my vintage, but it didn't really engage me. But I did take computer repair courses, and I took the web development courses at the time, which was all like tables and frame sets. Frame sets were pretty cool. So I did that, and I loved computers. My whole life was just computers and going to hardcore shows. But I decided that I didn't want to do it when I went to college and tried to do a bunch of other things.
So what'd you end up doing in college?
I did probably like seven majors. I'm pretty ADHD, and so like I'm interested in everything. And I went through graphic design, engineering, civil engineering, project management, construction management, music, history. I think I ended up just finishing with a history degree. I was like, I got to get out of here.
Understood. It seemed like though you liked to be kind of hands-on. You liked things that were real and tangible, like being able to tear apart the file system or the computer.
For sure. Yeah. It's a big part of why I've always liked my job and why I've stayed in this industry for a long time.
So after college, what do you end up doing?
After college, I got a job managing the IT department for a Boys and Girls Club. I think that was my first job. I had a couple that were like kind of tangential to tech. I did that and I worked at a company called Blue Wombat, which was this dude who was reselling industrial equipment on eBay. He was only like a year older than me, but a really smart guy. I still talk to him.
What kind of industrial equipment?
Like companies were going out of business left and right at the time. You know, this was like 2005 or so. So manufacturing kind of companies. And so we were buying up the whole lots of their stuff. You know, I learned a lot about these things that were valuable, like Kurt vices, these machinist vices and stuff we would resell. And so that was kind of interesting because I got to flex my web skills and build like listings and stuff for them because I hadn't really done anything like that. But I also got to get my hands dirty. I'd come home like covered in dirt and grime because like half the job was pulling machines out of factories and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, it's still going on today. I get emails from Tiger Industrial, who basically does that. They'll go in anywhere that someone's liquidating. They caught my eye because there was a production company in California. They also had an arm out here in Massachusetts randomly. And they were getting rid of like RE lights and like all the like real studio stuff. So that's what you see kind of scattered around the office.
Oh, cool.
Here.
Yeah. There was always a nice assortment of things that were not industrial that we got to pick up too. I was always kind of envious that I didn't have the pick of those items as we were finding them. But occasionally I got to take a couple things home.
Nice. And I think you were helping a buddy who was opening a bar at the time too, right?
Yeah, that was while I was doing the IT gig. I was teaching. It was a split job where they had a budget to pay basically for like an after-school program to teach kids some basic programming or website development and Lego robotics. And then during the day, I had to maintain their IT network. It might have been like 50 computers or something in the network. And it was already set up for me. So, you know, it was usually like fixing somebody's printer or something like that. But that was interesting and I enjoyed it. But then my buddy was opening up a bar and he's like, man, I want you to be a bartender. And I was like, well, that sounds a lot more fun than this right now, quite honestly. So I did take a detour for a while. I worked there for 2 years. And towards the end of that, I had been doing graphic design for a few different things because I had known how to use Photoshop from high school, like in my pirated Photoshop days. And so during that time, I also worked at a tattoo shop. I had answered the Craigslist ad to help them just finish the construction and kind of be like a gopher to go do various things. And that ended up being actually the big kind of stepping stone into my career, actually. The guy who owned that tattoo shop owned a company that made websites for tattoo artists. And it was actually like a really early social network. It's still out there. It's called Tattoo Now. And I was just like working behind the desk one day, taking people's IDs and stuff as they walked in. And he's like, hey, you know how to use Photoshop, right? Do you want to make a layout for this tattoo artist? You know, we have to get his website done. And I did it. And it was a lot of fun. I, you know, scanned the tattoo artist designs and got them into Photoshop and chopped them up and kind of made a web layout. And that was like the beginning of that whole career, actually. I started doing that and finding other clients in the brewing industry because I was working also at night as a bartender in a craft beer place. So between the two, it was a decent side hustle. And I realized, man, I got to do this full time. I liked bartending, but I'm not the best person probably to be taking abuse from customers long term. So I made the pivot there and went back to school actually to do a graphic design program at the local community college and then did a certificate program to get started.
And so after that, you end up going full time somewhere?
After that, no. I've dealt with a few friends of mine that have gone back to boot camp to learn to code and they feel really demoralized because it's so hard to find a job, I guess, right now, you know, as an entry-level person. And what I've said to them is like, man, when I started, it took me about 2 years to get like an entry-level job. I was still waiting tables in Boston, working like brunch, which is the worst possible thing to be a waiter for. And I was doing like internships, you know, some of them were unpaid. Luckily, I had a buddy who used to do the whole Wares thing in hardcore music together as teenagers, and he was smart enough to just stay focused on computers the whole time. He ended up at this place called the Barbarian Group, and he was able to help me get an internship there, which they did really incredible work at the time. That was really an incredible opportunity for me. And that was the first one. They paid me like minimum wage, but I got to be there 40 hours a week and do actual graphic design work for their clients.
Now, I saw that at the Barbarian Group, you said you were the oldest intern in company history.
I think so, yeah. I was probably like 26 or so at the time because they were like, you know, we don't usually hire interns that aren't in college, but I guess since we're paying you, we can just hire you as a minimum wage employee and let you hang out for the summer.
The story you tell there where you're trying to either off of some community college work or an associate's degree or doing a boot camp or whatever, like, yeah, breaking in's hard. Everyone's like, especially in the East Coast, like we want someone with experience. So you end up having to do stuff either at low or no pay to build up a little bit of a portfolio, whether you're a graphic designer or a coder or someone producing videos. And then you just start getting this critical mass and you have enough of a portfolio where you could start saying, hey, I want to do a longer term gig. And then the next thing you know, that elusive entry level full-time position or two comes out of the woodwork.
Absolutely. It's all about perseverance. And I think that's really important for people that are even trying to get started today to realize that it could take you a year or two to really get to where you want to be. But that's still a lot faster than people that had to go back to school for 4 years. You know, if you go to like a 3-month boot camp or something. And yeah, you know, that Barbarian internship was how I got my job because I moved back out to Western Mass. My partner at the time was going back to graduate school at UMass. And I applied to this place and they're like, oh, we've heard of the Barbarian Group. And that was basically the way that I got in.
Now, at the Barbarian Group, I saw you made the Rick Webb Black Metal 404. What is that?
Oh, that was sort of their like tradition that everybody that worked there had to make a 404 page. So unfortunately, they're all gone now. But at the time, if you hit a 404, it would randomly pick one. You know, there's probably like 100 of them. And one of the founders, Rick Webb, was a big personality and he just had a photo there. So I photoshopped him to look like one of these black metal dudes from Norway and like made it all a little animated thing with some death metal music and stuff. And everybody loved it. But people would always come up to me and be like, oh, we still love that 404 page. It's, I don't know. It didn't seem like a big deal at the time, but.
You never know what's going to resonate.
It's true.
So was that Fuzz Productions where you were finally working?
Yeah. And so like my path up until then was actually as a graphic designer, but I had taught myself more modern CSS while going to certificate school for graphic design. I opted not to do the whole program and to just try to train myself up at night to do the CSS stuff. And that worked out because they weren't hiring graphic designers, but because I had made custom WordPress sites and stuff like that, they hired me as a front-end developer, basically.
So you got another excellent trait there. I'll say it because I had it too when I was younger. And that's being willing to teach yourself and spend your off hours learning something. And if you have to find or invent some sort of project to just do something with it and flex the muscle a little bit, then you go to someone and the next thing you know, they're like, oh yeah, we need someone that does that.
Absolutely. I think that's super important and definitely something that I try to either instill in folks that work with me or hire that kind of quality. Too many people I've found are like, well, I don't know how to do that. It's like, well, go home and do it. You get paid really well. You should probably invest in yourself to learn those skills because you're not going to probably have the opportunity to just learn that on the job all the time. Sometimes you get lucky and you get to do that, but that's here and there.
And so where do you go from there?
Well, Fuzz was a really great opportunity for me. I started teaching actually a little bit at the certificate school. It was through Boston University. It's no longer in existence, I guess. My partner at the time ended up going to Germany to study. And I was just like, okay, I'll go with you. You know, I had a little bit of money saved up. I sold my truck, my beautiful black Tacoma that was almost paid off. And I took that money to go live off of and just did that for a few months. She was there for the whole year. I actually kind of ran out of money and came back to try to find more work. Unfortunately, I broke my arm like right before I was coming back. So that kind of sidetracked me. And I ended up accidentally getting hired at Aquint. They offered me like a senior level job, like double the salary that I had previously. I couldn't certainly turn that down. So I ended up not being able to go back to Germany for 6 or 8 months, I think.
And what'd you end up doing at Aquint?
I worked for their internal marketing department as a front-end developer. I had actually applied as a talent, as they would say, you know, because they're a talent agency. And I just was hoping they would find me some part-time work. But the guy who ran the marketing department saw my resume, I guess, and offered me that job. So, you know, building aquint.com or vitamintalent.com or vitamin T, I forget what domain they have, but that kind of stuff.
And then I think after that, at another gig, you were helping out with the Mini Cooper rebranding for the United States.
Yeah, I actually wasn't super happy, I guess, at my job at Aquint. And I asked them to place me for one of their clients and they did because like they still made money. I'm sure they made back a good part of my salary placing me. And I got hired at Beam, which was an agency in Boston. It was an awesome job working on a bigger team with like really great, talented, creative people. And the nature of the agency world, people are always coming and going. And so probably like 2 months, 3 months into it, somebody left and they needed somebody to lead the Mini Cooper resite. And so I got to do that. And that was a ton of fun.
That's cool. What technologies are they using at the time on the site? Like JavaScript front end?
They had a bad experience with Backbone. So they were shy from that. I think it was pretty early and probably overly ambitious. So we ended up doing the old-fashioned jQuery, which served its purpose at the time.
You ended up doing some Angular development after that, right?
Yeah, I did a little bit of Angular. Angular was kind of newish at the time, and I was trying to get them into it because the promise of Angular 1 for me as like a fairly visual kind of developer coming from graphic design was that there was a lot of magic in the two-way binding, which is a totally dangerous thing if you try to build really complex things. But to build what we used to do in jQuery, it was like incredible to have like your data and then just be able to do these directives to sort of spit out things. And it was unbelievable. But that was kind of short-lived because I was offered a job at Custom Made, which is where I met Mike, who, you know, founded ButcherBox as well.
Okay. What were they doing at Custom Made?
Custom Made was a two-way marketplace for makers and people who wanted something made. It was
like Etsy for hire.
Like Etsy for hire. Everything was bespoke basically at the time. And it was really interesting. It was kind of difficult, I think, of a problem because as a consumer, you're like, I want a table. And you can send somebody pictures of tables, but they're probably not going to make the table exactly how you have it in your mind. You know, it's that whole thing of getting an idea out of your head. And so there'd be like a lot of messaging back and forth. And it was just a really interesting problem, though, to work with those makers. And a lot of those people made a livelihood out of that platform for a while.
That's cool. So after Custom Made, what do you end up doing?
Custom Made was a really great place to work. They unfortunately ended up kind of running out of runway. And right before they laid off most of their folks, I took a different job with the COO of Custom Made, who started a company called Scratch, and they were doing a shopping platform. And so that was a lot of fun. At the same time, right before leaving, sort of around that time, I was talking with Mike. He was just starting the Butcher Box idea. And so it was really interesting to watch him grow that from nothing. But the Scratch project was really fun because I was able to get in there and do product design and front-end development and a little bit of product work with Matt. And he was a really terrific leader as well.
And did you go directly from there to ButcherBox?
No, that was fairly short-lived. I ended up wanting to move back to Western Mass, and I took a job for this company out in Western Mass that I was doing a little bit of freelancing for. And basically, I was like, look, like I know you guys aren't hiring, but let's figure something out so I can have a salary for the mortgage bank to basically give me a mortgage out here. Because I did work part remote for most of my career, but never fully remote. So that was always a sticking point to be able to transition the family at the time. And I had a daughter at the time, so it was pretty important to make that happen.
Yeah, that'll sober you up financially quick.
It sure will, yeah.
Yeah, the mortgage folks and the banking folk, they like to see that W-2 income. They can wrap their heads around that. If you say you're gig-based, they're like, ah.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's definitely been an important thing to remember going back and forth between the two.
And so from there, where do you end up working next?
So that was the agency called Common Media, and that was a lot of fun. I got to be a creative director of sorts that they were trying to get a design department going, and worked on some really interesting websites too, just sort of as like a lead engineer. But ultimately, I decided to leave and just start my own thing. I had gotten my mortgage and that was all set. Not that that was really the reason, but I was feeling restless, and I still talk with Noah, who's the founder of Common Media. We get lunch, and he's always described me as being really restless, that I keep trying to like just do another new thing. I can't stay put. So I did that. I started Invisible Machine. It was already going on for a little while, just to sort of as like a way to take income from side gigs and stuff. But when you leave your job and you have a mortgage to pay and family to support, it really does change your perspective on that hustle. And so that was the last day I played video games for probably 5 years, the day before I left my job, I remember. Because the next day I'm like, man, that's like $100 an hour that I'm wasting that I could be out in my office doing something. So that was an interesting lesson in that. And, you know, I did hire a few people to help me and landed some clients and was able to make it all work. It was really interesting to be in that position and to have a little bit more empathy for previous people that I worked for, understanding the running the business side of things. And not everything's going to be as perfect as you want, because I've always been a bit hardlined about wanting to do a really great job or a great product. And sometimes you just have to like do the best thing you can in the time that you can afford to spend on it.
Perfect is the enemy of done.
Absolutely. And I try to instill that in people on my team now. I definitely have some folks that work for me that are really talented, bright people, and they want to see things be really perfect and great. And I totally get that because I've been there, but you got to ship stuff quickly, you know? And that's really the thing, is figuring out the trade-offs.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So Mike calls you, says, we're putting the band back together. You got to come to ButcherBox?
No. There's a few other hops, I guess. I kind of burnt myself out doing the consulting. You know, running a hourly business, you only really make money when you're working. And it's amazing if you can get other people to work for you and you make money off of their labor. But the last sort of week or so of that job, I remember I was on vacation with my family and I was supposed to ship this app for a web application for the client, and it was due and we were behind, and I worked over 100 hours that week while on vacation, just totally ignoring my family, pulling all-nighters, literally like seeing phantoms in the middle of the night while I'm sitting in the chair because I'm so sleep deprived, and it's like, this stinks.
Try to go to bed, you have code dreams, you can't sleep.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, solve some interesting problems, I'm sure, through those code dreams. But I got an email from a guy back in Northampton that I kind of knew through the fuzz days. And he had started this company called Machine Metrics. And I'd always really liked what they were doing. It was like one of the only startups in Northampton that I knew of. And they were doing this sort of big data IoT thing, streaming data off of manufacturing machines and ingesting that and building real-time reporting on that kind of stuff. And he was just like, hey, are you looking for a job? And I said, well, honestly, no, but you're the only company that I'd probably consider right now. And that ended up working out. And so I kind of winded down my projects and joined company life again for a couple of years.
And then what happens after that?
After that, as per usual, I was feeling restless. Companies grow quickly, and I like to have a lot of different things going on. And I felt like I was doing more of one thing at that point because I had hired a lot of great people to sort of do a lot of the things that I like doing. And I was driving down the Mass Pike, not really sure what to do. And I just texted Mike. I was like, hey, I'm thinking about a change. Do you still need any engineering help at ButcherBox? And I didn't expect to even hear back from him that day. And I got a response and he's like, yeah, why don't you swing by? We're in Brighton. And so I just came by and met some of the folks there and ended up initially doing some consulting, which he had got me to then go full time.
And so what are you doing these days at ButcherBox? What's your purview?
Well, I started off doing front end stuff. They were in need of a lead front end engineer at the time. So started off with that and came up with a new sort of architecture for us using things like the Jamstack kind of stuff, Gatsby, Netlify, things like that. And about 8 or 9 months into it, there were some changes and I ended up taking over running the engineering team, which ironically, when I talked to the HR at ButcherBox, is like, I don't want to manage anybody. I just did that. I just want to be an individual contributor. And sure enough, you know, 2 weeks into it, I was managing two people, which they needed. I got that. So I've been running the engineering team. There's probably about 40 or so of us now, including full-time contractors. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been such an incredible opportunity to be at such a fast-growing company that was ready for a replatforming because they were bootstrapped from a Kickstarter. And so they grew and grew. And it was strategic too, that to not take venture capital money. So we never had this like huge fleet of engineers sort of building this perfect thing early on. And so to be able to come in and see like all the issues that I could solve with the team, it's just been a lot of fun.
So the customers are getting kind of super high quality meat shipped to them regularly. Like, how does the service work for those that don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. We sell grass-fed beef, different kinds of other proteins as well, all sort of animal welfare in mind, pork, chicken, salmon, scallops, things like that. And you can either buy a one-time box, which, you know, just one and done, or you can sign up as a member and get it every 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks, whatever works for you.
Okay. And as a ButcherBox employee, do they hook you guys up at all?
Oh yeah, they're super generous. We get a free box of meat every month.
And what do you select?
Ribeyes. Mostly all ribeyes, yeah.
Yeah, good call. They're certainly not cheap.
No, they're not. Ours are so delicious. Yeah.
Nice. What's your favorite way to make them? Do you grill them or?
I do like to grill. I don't have access to a grill at the moment. So I've been doing them in a cast iron pan and they've come out surprisingly well.
Everyone likes the grill marks and everything, but this guy, Meathead Goldwyn, runs a website called AmazingRibs.com. It's all about smoking, barbecue, grilling, etc. And he has this term, he says GBD, golden brown and delicious. And with a cast iron pan, you just got so much more surface area that's going to get golden brown and delicious when you cook it in there.
Absolutely. And I think what I've noticed too is that they're a lot juicier because you don't lose all the juices through the grill, basically.
Do you salt them ahead of time or anything?
I used to, and then who was it? There's some famous chef on TV who's like, you don't want to do that because it'll dry it out or something. So I usually wait till after the fact, but I wish that somebody that knew better would tell me one way or the other.
So I do know better.
Good.
And I'll tell
that's
you
why I'm here.
That you want salt on there ahead of time.
Okay.
Not too much and not too far ahead of time, or else it'll actually cure the meat, be almost like a bacony steak.
Uh-huh.
But you do want to get it on there. Salt tends to penetrate a half an inch an hour. And it will go in and you'll see some of it rise to the surface and make like a slurry, but then it goes right back in and it will make those steaks absolutely mouthwatering if you get it on there an hour or two ahead of time. Just throw it back in the fridge and then cook them when you're ready.
I'll definitely check that out next time.
So a lot of rubs contain salt, so you could just throw a rub on there. Problem is when you're in a ripping hot cast iron pan, those other spices will often burn in there. So usually just doing salt and then seasoning afterwards, or maybe like a little onion powder, garlic powder, SPOG, SPOG, salt, pepper, onion, garlic is a nice one to throw on there. Let it sit in the fridge for a couple hours and then hit the cast iron with it. In the pan, what do you use for oil?
I believe I've been using avocado oil or just grass-fed butter.
Like something with a high smoke point so you can...
Yeah, the avocado oil does a pretty good job of that. And then I've seen a few people cooking with butter on, I guess, TikTok.
Ghee, stuff that they use in Indian cooking is great. Super high smoke point, tastes great.
Awesome.
Definitely recommend.
I'll definitely check that out.
Cool. So you mentioned way back in the day, you're into hardcore music. What did you listen to? What shows did you go to?
Well, I was a teenager in the Worcester area of Massachusetts, for folks if they're not from this area. And there was a lot of great bands. My favorite band probably at the time was this band from Boston, although I think they are kind of from Worcester too. They used to practice in Worcester, called Overcast.
Okay.
They were kind of like a metal band, but they're a hardcore band as well. So bands like that, like a lot of the bands just from the area, bands like Converge and Overcast and, you know, a million other.
You know, like Slapshot or any of the Boston bands?
Slapshot was cool. They were probably a little earlier, and I know that a lot of my friends would listen to them sort of looking back a little bit, but I was less into that style of hardcore. I think as a kid, one of my first tapes was probably like Metallica and Justice for All when I was super young. And so like I've always been into metal as well, more so than like, you know, like I think people either like kind of get into hardcore through punk or they get into it through metal, and that sort of determines their
trajectory.
Yeah. And I was more on like the Pantera finding hardcore trajectory.
Yeah. I came from like the metal way back in the day, like Judas Priest and that sort of stuff. But yeah, once I got into hardcore, I think I leaned more punk / New York hardcore, like Agnostic Front and all those bands.
Yeah. Well, those bands are still a lot of fun to see.
I can't believe they're still around.
Yeah.
We were talking about concerts at UMass. Murphy's Law played there. And then they came over to our house afterwards and played a show in our garage for just me and my friends.
That's incredible.
That was pretty awesome. And they're still playing today. They just did a free show down in, I want to say, Tompkins Square Park, and they put up a Venmo or like a PayPal thing and took donations, and I guess it did well, and everyone was super happy to be seeing live music at the end of COVID.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I've gotten to see a few New York bands in New York, and it's always a really great experience.
I was in a band in high school, Truth and Effect, with a few other guys, and the bassist was this guy, Paul Romanko, who then went to play in a hardcore band in Western Mass, Bloodbath, and now he's, I don't know if they're still around, Shadows Fall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I recognize that name now that you mention it. Yeah, I used to listen to Shadows Fall because I also like lived in Western Mass as a kid. I booked a show with Shadows Fall at the Espresso Bar in Worcester early on, before the Brian Fair from Overcast ended up singing for Shadows Fall. So the first singer was Phil, who ended up being in that band, All That Remains. And that's kind of the era.
It's definitely a small world after all when it comes to Western Mass music.
It is. Yeah, I bump into Jay Maskus a bunch out there, which is always a hoot because he's pretty well known. I own his signature Fender guitar, but I remember like just walking into a Best Buy and there'd be Jay Maskus in his purple tracksuit looking at TVs and stuff. It was surreal.
So Lou Barlow played with him, was a bass player. His younger sister was in my high school class.
Very cool. Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of Western Mass music royalty, I guess, if you will. We lost Thurston and Kim a few years ago, that when they divorced and they moved away, but they used to be in Northampton too.
How is Northampton? Still bumping?
Still bumping. Pretty weird, as per usual. It's doing its thing. You know, a lot of the music has been consolidated under the Iron Horse group, which they kind of own all the things. And so they kind of dictate who comes to town now, which it's not as diverse and eclectic. Yeah, it's more like mainstream national acts.
Is Main Street Records still there? Or
no, no. They've been long gone, but I definitely have fond memories of picking up a tape or a 7-inch from them.
Used to be such a risk. You'd be like, all right, here's a band. I've heard maybe one song. Am I going to invest in an entire LP?
Oh, yeah.
That
yeah.
then I have to tape and it might suck and it's going to be like $15.
Absolutely. The risk of hearing somebody on a compilation tape and then you get the thing home. I definitely bought records, bands of the same name. It was just the wrong band, being like so bummed. Like, this is not at all the band I thought it was.
And not returnable.
Not returnable, no.
And now these kids, they have the SoundCloud and the Spotify and everything's next to free.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just to be able to sample music and discover it like that is just really incredible. Not to like be too get off my lawn, but it was really hard to discover music back then. You know, your friend probably had to find it, or, you know, maybe you got a zine or something that recommended it, but it was tough.
These young whippersnappers, they don't know how good they have it.
You know, there's too much too, though. I know I have a hard time with like Spotify because I put it on and I'm like, oh, I'm just going to skip to the next thing on a playlist. And you realize that when was the last time you listened to a whole album? You have too many choices.
My buddy Brad turned me on to The Idols. They're a UK band that I've been listening to a lot. And then through his band, The Attack, they're from Orlando. He tours with a bunch of bands and I got turned on to The Bronx. They're a punk band from LA.
Yeah, The Bronx. I saw them play South by Southwest in college. They were a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're really good. Well, we will also put some links in the show notes where you can learn more about topics we discussed in this episode. And we will have a link to all our other episodes, which are available at underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio, where you can find this episode and all our previous episodes to listen to on your favorite podcast client or right there on the website. So, Jeff, thank you for taking the long drive out and sharing with us your stories and experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
It's been my pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.